If you're just tuning in, this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. And we're talking to Brent Johnson about the history of Kasilof and the surrounding area, kind of in the early days of statehood. We were just talking a little bit about the Pollard family, about George Pollard. He passed away this year in 2021. Another person who was from this area who also died this year is Paul Fisher.
Yeah.
So Paul Fisher served on the Borough Assembly and was in the Alaska State Senate. How did he come to the area? What is his kind of origin story in this part of the state?
Well, he came in 1969. I can't remember exactly what drew him to the area, to tell you the truth. Hopefully some listener will call in and tell me that, because it's escaping me at the moment. But one thing is for sure, once he got here, he was very involved with kids. He had a big family, and he coached football. He had a bakery, and his wife was on the school board, Joyce, for like 13 years or something. And then he got elected to the Borough Assembly. So he was always involved in politics. They were pretty hardcore Republicans. Like, if you go to the Republican caucus or whatever they do, you know, every year where they organize whatever it is they're organizing. Mm-hmm. My dad went a few times, and I don't know if he drugged me along or how I got there, but I went as well. And I remember Paul Fisher was always there. Mm-hmm. And so he was a big part of that organization. But yeah, he got elected to the Senate. It was actually a pretty close race. In fact, Paul Fisher, he got elected to the Senate in 1982 by 52 votes. So can you imagine? I've seen so many things in history that are they could have gone either way, but because they went the way they went, then history is like it is.
Sure. 52 votes.
So he arrived in 69 and he got elected to the Assembly in 1975, and he served on the Assembly 22 years. He was elected 9 times, and so that just, that's way more than anybody else. So number two, Betty Glick and Grace Merkus both were elected 7 times. And they both served about 17 years. And so that's an eternity, practically. Mm. And then you have John Davis from KSRM. He was elected 6 times and served 13 years.
Wow.
And then there's Jack Brown. He served about 14 years and was elected 5 times, I guess.
Wow. And the folks from Kasilof, that's in the seat that you are serving.
That's the seat I'm in now, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... Jack Brown wasn't in that seat. Paul Fisher was.
Okay. Got it.
And it's fuzzy as could be, because when we think of District 7 and the Kasilof seat, there wasn't always a District 7.
Sure.
And there wasn't always a Kasilof seat.
So what are the kind of some of the things that the Borough Assembly was talking about at that time? What were some of the issues that Paul Fisher maybe was thinking about when he was on the Assembly?
Well, lots of things. Building the hospital was huge in the early 70s, and so I would assume that he was probably involved in some of those discussions. It might have been slightly before his time, not 100% sure, but building the hospital was a big deal. There was a proposal to have it in Clam Gulch for a while.
Really?
Per Osmer, who is like the forefather of Clam Gulch, was a big promoter for the hospital. And but yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, we talked to Clark Fair about the tumultuous history of the hospital and how it was in all these different proposals for it being in all, a couple different places. So yeah, I imagine that was a big topic of conversation.
And then school issues were always a big deal for Paul. Gosh, the harbor at Ninilchik had to be dredged all the time, and that had to have been an issue on his plate. Roads, what have you. I remember the last time he got on the Borough Assembly, invocations was one of the big reasons that he ran.
Interesting. What was the conversation about invocations then?
Well, when I was on the Assembly previously, there was a Peninsula Pastors Fellowship, something like that, that was a organization of local pastors from Christian churches that... And whenever the assembly had an invitation, they just delegated who it was going to be to that group. That group picked who it was going to be. And so it was easy for the assembly that they would just have somebody show up every meeting. And if they didn't have somebody show up, I even led maybe four or five prayers before the assembly. But later, there became a controversy because it actually developed during the marijuana issue. There were quite a few people from the religious community and pastors that were against marijuana being allowed in the borough. The cities were beyond our being able to say, so we were just talking about the in the borough in general. But anyway, the people that came to promote the marijuana listened to the people that came and didn't want marijuana. And in my opinion, some of them took a grudge. Now, this could be completely wrong. But at any rate, right after that time, there was a big move and a for other people to be involved in given the invocation, not just Christians. And so the borough attorney said that you probably got to let this happen because, you know, it'd be be the rights of everybody to do it. So eventually that's what has happened is now you will have the spaghetti folks. I forgot what they call themselves, but they're little.
The flying spaghetti.
Yeah, those guys or what have you.
And that was when Paul was serving on.
The last time he served that, he got elected in 2016, the last time. And that controversy hit the lawsuit stage right after that.
Wow. So what was Paul Fisher's personal life like? What was his what was his familial situation? Do we know? Where did he live?
Oh, he lived right there by across from the Decanter Inn.
Okay.
And so that homestead was like Lola and Neilan Harberger, or I'm not sure exactly how you say that last name, but they built Lola's Bar there in about 1959 when we moved here. And so they had that whole area homesteaded, and they sold the place across the street there, I think, was built by maybe the Starr family. And then the Parks family lived there. And then Fisher's. And so, you know, I don't know the history of that for sure. But that's where they lived. That's where they've lived for almost the time they came to Alaska. And, yeah, now that he's got that, they have built a big shop next to it. They were into making trophies and plaques and that sort of thing.
Wow. And then when what years was he on the Alaska State Senate? Do we know?
Sure. So he got elected to the State Senate in 1982, and he got reelected in 1986. And then in 1992, he ran again. Suzanne Little, who was a borough assembly woman, also ran, and she won. And so that's when he retired.
Wow. And you mentioned Jack Brown. He This is the, you know, another Kisilov resident who died this year.
Yes.
And he was also on the borough assembly.
Yes.
What's kind of his story?
Well, his story is he came up from California and moved to Nikiski with his family. So when he was on the borough assembly, he was representing Nikiski. He was instrumental in very many things. Girls and Boys Club, getting it up and running. He co-founded with Aaron Goforth Industry Appreciation Day, which has grown into a really big deal. He was a friend of both the commercial fishermen and the oil industry, and that's quite a feat to accomplish, but he really was. Basically, he was involved in lots of programs. He worked with youth a lot prior to coming and always promoted things like Girls and Boys Clubs. In fact, he helped when, I think I was on the assembly, when we had a meeting at Tustamina, and one of the things, the needs that was expressed was something for kids to do after school while they're waiting for their parents to come pick them up when they, because they couldn't, parents that worked didn't want their kids to go home alone when they were young kids, and they were working. And so, so anyway, he helped get a Girls and Boys Club program started for after the school.
So he moved to Nikiski, it looks like, around 1980. So what kind of, you know, what was the area, we're now kind of going back to Kisilov, in the 1980s and 90s, how was the area different from what we were talking about in those earlier stages? How would you kind of characterize the area at that time in history?
So after oil was discovered in 1957, then all of a sudden you had gas wells and oil wells and all kinds of exploration, a lot of geophysical work. And so there were a lot of people that worked in the oil industry. And there was a big difference. My friends who worked in the oil industry, you know, they would come to school with their white bread and bologna sandwiches, and I was just jealous as could be. I had that homemade bread with salmon salad, but it turns out later now, and you couldn't get me to eat what they ate. But anyway, so there was just a lot of work in the oil industry, and it paid good money. Mm-hmm. Fishermen was always a boom and bust deal, and there was a lot of bust.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of development in industries that were based on oil, you know, helping industries. So, yeah, that it just was a lot of growth. The area was designed to be homesteaded. And so, like, we had to clear, I think, 20 acres to have a homestead, which was super expensive and totally stupid because it's not, of all the homesteads, there's like 2% that ever became farmers. My wife's family being one.
Really? Was there a lot of conflict between the oil and fishing industries in the area? Or
no. No, I mean, we had the Glacier Bay oil spill in 1987, which was a conflict because we got oil in our net. But then they ended up, I think there was a lawsuit and they paid. And so, and then, of course, there was the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. That was a super whammy that put the drifters, they couldn't fish all year. But again, I don't feel like there was a lot of conflict. There were people that fished and worked for the oil company. There was a lot of people that worked for the oil companies and fished.
Yeah. Kind of jumping ahead to Kisilov today. How would you kind of, you know, describe the change in those decades? We were talking about before this that the census numbers have just come out and there's a few dozen fewer residents in Kisilov in 2020 than in 2010 based on those census numbers. But at the same time, there are, of course, more properties being built in the area. I mean, what is kind of the character of the area now in terms of who's coming in and maybe who's leaving the area?
Yeah, so, you know, there were good people then and there's good people coming now. But one of the big differences is just recently in the last, we'll call it the last 9 or 10 years, commercial fishing has really taken it hard. And so there is very big dip netting and sport fishing opportunities, and the commercial fishing opportunities are much less than they used to be. So I would say that that's a big thing. The hospital has grown and grown until it's a huge factor on the Kenai Peninsula. It has been for years. Homer Hospital is growing. I predict it will also succeed and be a big factor. And so they benefit everybody in a couple of ways. You don't have to go to the States or to Anchorage if you want to have whatever done. They can do most things here. And so that's a benefit for people. And then they provide their own little sub-economy, you know. There's so many doctors and so many nurses and whatnot, maintenance people that work at the hospital and building that goes on all the time, that finds its way into the economy. And then all those doctors and all those people, they live in houses, and those houses are taxed.
Sure.
So anyway, it's a big boon for the economy. In some ways, it's disappointing to me that the prices of medical stuff is so insane. I still don't go to the doctor when I probably should because, you know, who's going to pay gobs and gobs of money for something? And I don't feel so I have borough insurance now, but I don't want to use it because I know that just makes it expensive for everybody. So it's ugly. I want to have the same hospitals that we have now, thriving and whatnot, but I think that the price should be way better.
Well, and of course, even if the hospitals are relatively close, there's no Clam Gulch Hospital or anything like that. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of distance to, you know, the towns of Homer and Soldotna, do you find that the people who move to Kisilov or who stay in Kisilov are people who kind of want to be more off the grid? Like when you're talking about kind of the people who choose to make Kisilov their home, do you find that same kind of homesteading spirit that we're talking about in these kind of earlier families from the time?
In my opinion, there's no comparison to the people that homesteaded with no electricity, no indoor plumbing, you know, no roads and things like that. The people that are here now, sure, they have, they love to get out of the city, and who doesn't, you know? But whenever they need a book, they run to the library and get a book. Whenever they need to, something from the grocery store, they can zip to Soldotna.
Yeah, the convenience factor is so different.
It is, and it's so easy. Everybody's got cars, and they're probably getting 30 miles a gallon or something.
And they're complaining about the dirt roads. That there's no comparison.
Yeah, right.
That's really funny. And so I want to kind of pivot a little bit to talk about the Historical Association.
Yeah.
So you're president of the Kisilov Regional Historical Association, and you guys actually have a museum. Is that, I know there's kind of a couple different parts to it. So you were closed for a lot of COVID, reopened the summer. What can folks find there, and when is it open?
So it's open 1 to 4 on most days. And they have docents that will explain and show guests whatever they, you know, we have. And there is lots of interesting stuff, from fox farming to set netting, commercial fishing. I know my granddaughter found a mammoth tooth, and that's in the museum, found it on the beach. And
oh my goodness.
There's just lots of natural and whatnot kind of history there. It's really a lot of stuff put in a small space. And then there's the buildings. They have several buildings that have been moved on site. Each one of those represents a huge project, and they're all really interesting to try to think about the people who built these buildings when there were no roads, and did it with handsaws and axes and whatnot.
When you think about the history of this area, what do you find the most interesting? What kind of percolates most in your brain?
So to begin with, I would start with the Russians. Kisilov was the second place on the mainland that the Russians settled. Nanwalik being the first, or we used to call it English Bay when I was a kid. The Russians called it Alexandrovsk. But that was the first. That was 1785, and Kisilov 1786. So we're talking right after the Revolutionary War. Before people were even, you know, Lewis and Clark hadn't made it to the West Coast yet. And so that's way back. And then they started their fort at Kenai in 1791. And then, so I have to always think about those Russians and how horribly they treated the natives. And yet the church came with the Russians, the Russian Orthodox Church. And that Russian Orthodox Church is still surviving today and is still meaningful today. And it's bizarre to me in a way, because there's such a tendency for local people to reject a new religion coming in. But it turned out that those Russian Orthodox priests befriended the natives, something that the Russian fur hunters didn't do. Baranov and his gang were like slave drivers. And so naturally, they gained an affection for the church.
Yeah, I was going to ask, were the Russians kind of displacing a lot of Dena'ina people when they came to the area?
You know, the Dena'ina people, I wouldn't say so much. I'm not an expert on this. I mostly read history, none of the natives in Alaska had a written language. But for sure, the Aleuts. The historians estimate, I think, there was like 30,000 Aleuts when the Russians came, and there were maybe 10,000 when they left. And so, they treated the Aleuts super miserably. And that's no other word for it. And they treated the other people, whether it's a Dena'ina or the Tlingits or what have you, they treated them all miserable. But not so bad with the later group, because the later group were able to defend themselves better. They had assets and land that they could get away from.
The missionaries you're talking about?
No, no, no. I'm talking about the ordinary Aleuts. Ordinary Aleuts all lived on villages that were very close, on islands that were very close to the water, and there was no place to go to get away from the Russians, for hunters and whatnot. But the other natives had places they could go to get away better. And so I'm not an expert. That's, I think, a way they survived. And in some ways, when the smallpox vaccine came in, Father John Veneminov, I probably am pronouncing that wrong, he inoculated them, and the Russian doctors inoculated them. And it didn't take the natives very long to figure out that people that got inoculated lived and the people who didn't died. And so, that helped to a certain extent too.
Hmm. You mentioned the Russian Orthodox presence in the area. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's that beautiful church in the Nilchik, mm-hmm. and a Russian Orthodox community there. Are there still a lot of Russian Orthodox folks living in the Kisilov area now?
Well, in the Nilchik, there certainly are. I wouldn't say Kisilov has many at all, but the Nilchik still holds services, and there's still some people, and not just old-timers, but the children of old-timers and the grandchildren of old-timers. I think they appreciate the heritage of the Russian Orthodox Church, and so they go and want to learn. I had somebody recently tell me that the Dena'ina language is a dying language, and certainly the dialect that, well, whatever language they spoke at, the Nilchik native language, that isn't the pure, you know, that was a mixture of Russian and whatever the native language was. So, and I think that those, anyway, the bottom line is that there's a real appreciation for that heritage. It's kind of interesting. The Russian Orthodox Church and the Christian churches that came later haven't exactly meshed in warmness, but there's been a resistance, and yet there's other natives that were converted to Christianity that are thrilled with that.
Do you find any inspiration for your own life in the lessons that we hear about in this Kisilov history? Are there anything that inspires you hearing these kind of early stories?
Everything inspires me. You know, anytime I read about somebody like George Pollard that took care of his wife who was bedridden for 10 years, that's inspiring. It makes me think that maybe I could at least do the dishes. But sure, I mean, my gosh, my mom and my dad were pretty amazing to carve out a little niche. When we homesteaded, the Jacksons, the Kingsleys, the Richardsons, George Martin, and I'll think of the other guy's name in just a second. They all lived there. Pretty soon, a bunch of they all left, is my point. And I don't think that we stuck it out because we were better than the others. It's just that the way it happened, you know. But I can't help but admire all those people. People who knew Clovis Kingsley, he was a cool guy. He's the guy that got my mom to go set netting. He suggested that she do that. Mm. And Jackson, of course. I talked to Mrs. Jackson when I was writing this book. So that was like 2010 or whatnot. And that was a wonderful experience. They were set netters, started the cannery. Mm. Anyway, a lot of thrilling people. You talk to any of these old-timers, Bartolowicz, Judy's parents, all of those people, Broxy, you know, just on and on and on, the McLean family. Those were real people. Mm-hmm. But not that we aren't now. It's just that the circumstances are way different.
Mm. And you mentioned the book. I'd like to give a little shout out to some of the books we're referencing. So,
number one book is Once Upon the Kenai. It's put together by the Kenai Historical Society. And that's if anybody's interested in local history, you got to get that. I think they are still available at the bookstore. And then the second book would be, it's Alaska's Kenai Peninsula, The Road We've Traveled. It was put together by Kenai Peninsula Historical Association. And so that historical association is an umbrella group that has the Seward, which is called Resurrection Bay Historical Society, the Cooper Landing Historical Society, the Hope Historical Society, Kenai, Saldana, and Kisilov Historical Societies. But anyway, they're the ones that made this book here, and it was done, I don't know, maybe 50, I can't remember. But anyway, it's a a follow-up to this first book. And then the last book that I've got is Snapshots at Statehood, and that again was put together by the Kenai Peninsula Historical Society. In that book, I just happened to be president of the group when Tim Navarre was the chief of staff for John, the mayor. I can't believe I can't remember his last name at the moment. But anyway, he had asked the group to put together a book on what was going on in the Kenai Peninsula during statehood, when the borough, of course, wasn't yet even 50 years old, when the state was 50 years old or whatever. And so anyway, this book is the outcome of that.
And yeah, we have all these books here. We're referencing them. Really valuable resources, a lot of primary source accounts and photos. Really wonderful. We're wrapping up. That's about all the time we have. So it's a great place to end it. Brent, thank you so much for being here, for walking us through this history. So fascinating. So many amazing families and people to talk about. So thank you for being here today. You're tuned into the Kenai Conversation. I'm Sabine Pooks. Thanks for tuning in.